Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, February 23rd, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I will start with the From the Editor's column, and then On the Cover will follow. And then Our World, Reporters on the Job, The Explainer, The Home Forum, and the editorials. So, getting right into it, the From the Editor's column is entitled International Reporting Beyond the U.S. Storyline. This is written by Stephanie Haynes, who's the print editor, and you can email her at haness@csmonitor.com. And she writes, before senior global correspondent Mark Sappenfield traveled to Greenland last month, we spoke about what sort of insights we hoped in an in-depth story about the territory might offer to our readers. There were, after all, a lot of stories about Greenland in the mainstream press at the time. Most of these focused on President Donald Trump's assertion that the United States needed to take control of the island for security reasons, or on Europeans' vehement objections to this plan. Analysts weighed in on everything from the role of Greenland in filling the world's critical mineral needs to its significance in controlling North Arctic shipping lanes. But Mark wanted to go beyond those headlines. He wanted, he explained to me, to try to also show readers the situation in Greenland from the Greenlandic perspective. There's a line from the story where I say that the singular focus on Greenland as a pawn in the imperial game leads to a very warped view of Greenland, he wrote to me after filing the story. Like you, I've seen very little news coverage about Greenland on its own terms. The Monitor and Mark has a history of this sort of coverage. When Mark covered Afghanistan, for instance, he did not embed with the military because, as he puts it, I felt that wasn't the story. Instead, he says, I traveled around Afghanistan trying to tell Afghan stories. I'm sure the U.S. story was valuable, but I wanted our readers to see Afghanistan as a three-dimensional place. It's still one of the most amazing places I've ever been, with the most generous people. He dressed in a salwar kameez, although, as he notes, nobody would mistake him for an Afghan. I can't grow a beard, he says. Mark says he stuck out in Nuuk, Greenland, too, and part of that was because of how he was approaching his job, with the Monitor ethos that people and places have inherent value and import, not just because of what they mean to the U.S. or any other superpower or storyline. Two of his sources, he said, told him that they agreed to talk only because I was doing a different kind of story. Otherwise, they said, they were done talking to the media. That was the From the Editor's column this week, written by Stephanie Haynes, who's a print editor. And this week it was entitled International Reporting Beyond the U.S. Storyline. And now for On the Cover. As the world fights over Greenland, its people double down on their own values. Greenlandic culture and identity, rooted in Inuit traditions, have seen a revival. As the world clamors for its rare earth minerals and energy potential, will its people be able to choose their own path? This is written by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent. From Nuuk, Greenland, amid the kayaks, local costumes, and Arctic mummies that a visitor might expect to find in the Greenland National Museum, there's a curious addition, a Sears catalog. The yellowing pages hold a strangely pivotal place in the history of Greenland. They tell of the moment when the United States first came to the world's largest island, which stretches deep into the Arctic Circle. Compelled to defend it against Nazi Germany during World War II, the U.S. did something more. It ushered in a wave of cultural change that dramatically altered Greenland's future, symbolized by the Sears catalogs that were sent to almost every resident living there at the time. More than 75 years later, the U.S. wants to return, this time as owners. Though he has toned down his demands, President Donald Trump cites Greenland's crucial role in defending the U.S. from long-range missile attacks and the threats of an increasingly open Arctic Ocean. Mr. Trump's attempts to take over the island cast Greenland in the role of passive imperial pawn. The reality is much more dynamic. Greenland's 57,000 people are waking up. As they gain more autonomy from Danish rule, there has been a revival of Greenlandic culture and identity, and the territory has begun to chart a path unlike any national government in the world. Nowhere else does an indigenous community hold so much power and influence over national affairs, with 90% of Greenlanders identifying as Inuit. The result is a new model of governance guided by indigenous values. Here, no one is allowed to own land, and society is built on a sense of communal well-being that goes deeper than any theoretical Westernism, residents say. When you are part of a smaller community, there is a different way to be around one another, says Malu Rosing of the International Work Group for Indigenous Affairs in Copenhagen, and a native Greenlander. It's a society where the stronger have to help the weaker. To Greenlanders, this is a different kind of freedom, one in which communal ties to one another and to the land are at the foundation of a caring and mutually dependent society. For many here, Mr. Trump's threats were a threat not just to a government or a military, but to a way of life. Even as the American president softens his demands, a deeper question behind them remains. What will happen to Greenland from here? The challenge facing Greenland is in many ways the same challenge that has beset indigenous communities worldwide for centuries. Engage with the broader world and risk being overrun, or remain independent at the cost of isolation and lost opportunity. No one thinks navigating that choice will be easy. Many believe it could take years, even decades. But the threat of a U.S. invasion and takeover has forced Greenlanders to think about what they want their future to be. There is a huge awakening in this moment, says Liv Aurora Jensen, a graphic designer in Nuuk, the capital and home to about one-third of Greenlanders. The people's voice in Greenland is becoming more and more clear. This is obvious throughout Nuuk, where street corners are a riot of Greenland's flag, a modernist red and white interpretation of the famous Arctic sunset. Called Ærfuglasorput, or Our Flag, it hangs in shop windows, is displayed on cars, and sits atop nearly every flagpole. But the evidence of Greenland's cultural revival is also apparent in Ms. Jensen's kitchen and on her own skin. Outside the window is a classic scene of Greenlandic winter, brightly colored houses clinging to the weather-beaten rock, the fjord beyond fretted with the shocking blue of calved glacier ice. Inside is a portrait of the new Greenland. Nearly everything is a product of the design company Inuk Media, run by Ms. Jensen and her husband, filmmaker Peter Jensen. Contemporary plates, curtains, and cutting boards are etched with traditional Greenlandic symbols and given a modern twist. Ms. Jensen's designs have won awards from Slovenia to Japan to Germany. As she sets the breakfast table, lines of blue dots around her forearm become visible. It's a traditional Greenlandic tattoo, and only a decade ago, it was close to becoming a lost art when only two people on the island knew how to etch them into skin. Now, such tattoos are commonplace. We are seeing a very, very visual desire to show off our culture, says historian Ujemingak Engel, recalling a 2017 exhibition she did on Greenlandic tattooing. She adds, I had never worked on anything that created such demand. These expressions of cultural independence are in politics, too. Since 2009, Greenland has been able to manage its internal affairs, while Denmark controls defense, foreign policy, and currency. But polls find Greenlanders want more. They don't want to be a part of the U.S., or Denmark for that matter. Some 84% want to be independent, according to a January 2025 survey by Greenlandic and Danish media. Yet there are telling asterisks. More than half, say it will not happen for 10 to 20 years, and 45% say they do not want independence if it affects their standard of living. Currently, more than half of Greenland's public revenues are grants from Denmark. Independence would mean finding ways to replace that. In the past, the task seemed nearly impossible, with Greenland's economy almost wholly reliant on fishing. But a new moment of opportunity beckons. The globe is clamoring for the minerals and energy Greenland has in abundance. How it chooses to develop that wealth, or not, could prove the biggest test of its ideals. In recent years, Greenland has become the blank slate for powerful people's economic dreams. Not only does the world's largest island hold some of the largest deposits of rare earth minerals, minerals increasingly essential for modern technology, it also has massive hydropower potential. Business leaders see Greenland as a prospective source for huge amounts of cheap energy to run power-thirsty data centers. In the U.S., a Reuters report suggests several tech billionaires have floated the idea of establishing a freedom city in Greenland, a libertarian utopia with limitless energy and minimal government oversight. The report states that the vision for Greenland could include a hub for artificial intelligence, autonomous vehicles, space launches, micro-nuclear reactors, and high-speed rail. Naja Nathanielsen's own vision is dramatically different. Greenland's economic minister is open to investments, but she is unflinching that they must not harm Greenland's values and ways of life. She and her people have no misgivings about foregoing lucrative development opportunities that have any whiff of exploitation of people or the environment. "We've built in high expectations," says Ms. Nathanielsen, who also serves as Greenland's Minister of Justice. "One reason we don't have a lot of mines is that we have higher standards." "I cannot lower the standards," she adds. "We will lose the backing of the local community." Economic growth cannot be destructive to the very communities it purports to benefit. "We could develop 100 mines and hydropower, but that would require a lot of workforce coming in from the outside and put a great stress on our culture," she adds. "We want tourism, but we don't want to be overrun in our small communities." Christian Keldsen understands the desire to set such high standards, but the director of the Greenland Business Association in Nuuk says the government might need to be more flexible if it wants to hit its economic goals. "If I want to attract investment, I need to be able to accommodate what investors want," he says. "It's not enough to say we're open for investment." He points to utility costs, which are the same across Greenland from a relatively urban Nuuk to the many isolated settlements spread across the island. The goal of such price controls is to support Greenlanders living in remote settlements. But the government could do that in other ways, like subsidies, he says, that would allow utility prices to more fairly reflect market demands. "It's an ambition of the government to be an exporter of energy," says Mr. Kelson. "But to sell surplus energy, you need to sell it at a lower price." Some of these tensions have played out dramatically at the Kvænefjeld mine, which overlooks the fjords near a town or the town of Narsaq at the southern tip of Greenland. Australia-based Energy Transition Minerals has held the mining rights since 2007, but in 2021, Greenland banned uranium mining, a practice that has caused significant damage to indigenous communities from Canada and Australia. While Kvænefjeld is not a uranium project, there was enough uranium present to shut down operations. Energy Transition Minerals is now suing Greenland for more than $11 billion. Mr. Knelson declines to comment on the case, but speaking generally, he says there are opportunities for greater understanding between the government and the business community. "We need to be bringing more data and a more contemporary mindset on this," he says. "We're looking for more trust." For her part, Mrs. Nathanielsen is comfortable with keeping the standards high. The growing need for rare earth minerals and energy will eventually bring the right companies to Greenland's doorstep, she says. If they could add even 3 mines in the next 10 years, she adds, that would make a real change for our economy. Peter Jensen, Ms. Jensen's husband, has some sympathy for the challenges businesses face in Greenland. He came to Nuuk in 1985 as a 20-something hoping to become Greenland's first great movie maker. But his initial experience was moving from house to house every night since the only apartments available were controlled by the government and there was a 10-year wait. When he eventually decided to form his own media company, he tried to get a bank loan but failed despite having 1 million Danish krona in business commitments. A friend offered his fishing boat as collateral. The bank still said no. Finally, Mr. Jensen had to go door to door to raise funds, eventually getting the owner of one of Nuuk's biggest fishing operations to front the money in exchange for ownership of half the company. He was sleeping about 2 hours a night. Over time, Mr. Jensen became the grand old man of Greenlandic film, producing documentaries, commercials, and collaborations with major companies like Disney. Years later, he married Liv, who was by then his business partner, and they moved to Denmark. They thought they might never return. We were tired of being in Greenland, he says. It's so hard to be an entrepreneur here, he says. But after he left, he found he missed being home. In those 2 years, I realized how much I loved this country. He looks out of his kitchen window across the fjord and knows one thing. No one owns that land. We have this kind of feeling of freedom, how we are apart from the world, he says. You can just go out into nature and shoot your own food. Ms. Jensen chimes in that it is not unusual or controversial for even a government minister to call in and say he's going hunting that day. That's what makes us very proud. It's our land. It's our soul, she says. Business is hard for her here, too. If I have to produce something, it has to be abroad, she says. Greenland does not have the industry she needs to make her household goods, but she thinks Greenland has its priorities right, and the world can learn something from that. It's not all about money, Mr. Jensen said. There can be a new way of doing things, and Greenland can be a model. Part of Greenland's path forward means finding a way through the past, and that means wrestling with Denmark's complicated colonial legacy. In some ways, Greenland was fortunate. One of the reasons Greenlandic colonial history is so different is that we were colonized on a very different philosophical grounding than any other place, says Ms. Engel, leader of the Nuutaqaat Local Museum in Nuuk. The Christian ministry, who first established a permanent Danish presence on Greenland in 1721, Hans Egede, came with an unusual respect for the native culture. In other places, the arrival of the church often meant the complete erasure of a culture, says Ms. Engel, but Egede fought quite hard to preserve a lot of the cultural heritage we have today. That meant Greenland kept hold of many of its traditional practices and, perhaps most important, its language. But some traditions, such as tattooing, largely disappeared. More problematic was the relationship established between Danes and Greenlanders, which was unambiguously paternal. In later years, the Danish government turned Egede's ideals into policy, passing laws that kept Greenlanders locked in time. Up until World War II, Greenlanders were required to sew their own clothes, and simple items like petroleum lanterns were deemed too modern. That's when the Sears catalogs came in. With the Nazi takeover of Denmark, Greenland turned to the U.S. for defense. The powerful neighbor gladly accepted but did not care about keeping Greenland Greenlandic. So in came American feature films, radio, and Sears catalogs, cracking open a new world. It was the first time the Greenlandic people had a say, says Ms. Engel. While the rest of the world was burning, the Greenlandic people felt a sense of freedom, of evolving. When Danish control returned, the tables flipped. Denmark pushed modernization at a dizzying speed, but the reasserted sense of colonial control brought devastating consequences. Danish authorities closed isolated settlements and forced residents into cities where they had no social standing or understanding of even how to use modern facilities like toilets. All the evolutions you had in the rest of the world, we went through all those different phases in 30 years, says Ms. Engel. As a byproduct of that, a lot of people lost their identity and purpose. Alcoholism soared, as did suicides. From the 1960s to the 1970s, the Danish government implanted contraceptive devices in thousands of teenage Greenlandic girls, some as young as 12, without their or their parents' consent, an official effort to keep the population of Greenland down. There is a dark, dark history between Greenland and Denmark, says Frederik Fuja Larsen, curator of the Greenland National Museum in Nuuk. For Raquel Sanamuniak, overcoming that darkness has been a decades-long struggle. At age 4, she felt called to become a shaman, using ancient Inuit traditions and connections to ancestors to bring healing. But her mother said it was too dangerous. The Danes didn't understand. Mrs. Sanamuniak heard stories about how kids had thrown rocks at her great-grandmother for following the traditional ways. At a boarding school in Denmark, she was told her beliefs were evil. I tried my very best to adapt, she says. Still, she went through severe crises and attempted suicide more than once. Applying Western methods to a spiritual crisis, it wasn't working for me, at least. But in recent years, Mrs. Sanamuniak has felt a dramatic shift. When a priest on live television put Christianity and traditional Inuit beliefs on equal footing, it was a historic moment. Both sides need to come together to find restoration as equals, says Mrs. Sanamuniak, who now has her own practice in Nuuk. What I see is a balance slowly being restored. We had to cope in silence, she adds. Now the Danes are listening, and that is part of the healing. That is all we need, freedom to be who we are. The mirror of colonization is that we're not good enough to be who we are. Mr. Larsen of the National Museum has seen how insidious this sense of inferiority can be. In the past, when his museum was asked to work on research projects with others, it was rarely given any more than a brief credit line at the bottom. Greenlandic researchers tacitly accepted themselves as second class. But that has changed, and he has helped change it. In the past decade, Mr. Larsen began issuing an ultimatum. If you want to work with us, we want an equal voice. It worked. Ironically, Mr. Trump's interest in Greenland might be giving Greenland and Denmark the chance for a similar reset. There are signs that Denmark is now listening to Greenland in ways it had not before. For years, Greenland has demanded an apology from Denmark for its contraception campaign. But it wasn't until Mr. Trump returned to office with his designs on Greenland that Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen issued a formal apology describing it as systemic discrimination. Women affected by the policy can also apply for $46,000 each in reparations. In that way, Greenland's revival is not only an attempt to reclaim indigenous traditions, but an attempt to find new ways to engage with Denmark and the world. To Mala Johnson, that can only be a good thing. The former auto mechanic plays a part in Greenland's anti-hero to a T. Seated casually in a chair of the cafe of Nuuk's decidedly Nordic-style cultural center, Mr. Johnson is a revolutionary in fleece. His manifesto is the clothing he wears. His brand, Bolt Lamar, is arguably Greenland's hottest clothing line. He and co-owner Amy Mogensen said they were tired of sunsets and polar bears and kayaks, all the familiar icons of Greenlandic art. Everyone used Greenlandic stuff to the point of being souvenirs, Mr. Johnson says. We wanted to do something completely opposite. So they created a line of streetwear that would not look out of place in South Central Los Angeles. At first, no one knew it was Greenlandic, and they worked hard to keep it that way. They used foreign models on photo shoots to make us feel bigger than we were. they kept a low profile. Along the way, however, Boat Lamar did become quintessentially Greenlandic. Fishermen wear their clothes as workwear. Teens wear them clubbing. Now, many people in town know where it comes from. For both partners, Boat Lamar became a way to whiten Greenlanders' world. "We wanted to show that you don't have to be specifically Greenlandic," says Mr. Mogensen. "We can be anything. We are citizens of the world." In her own way, Ms. Jensen of Inuk Media sees something similar. "When I travel around the world and see different cultures, my own becomes much clearer. The question now is how much to open that world. We want to let in the world, but we want peace and quiet," says Mr. Johnson. "We want tourists, but we want the place for ourselves. We're very welcoming, but at the same time, there's a part of us saying, shut up. We just want to hear the wind." You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now for Our World in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This is a global news roundup compiled by the Monitor's international team. And the first one is a Chilean counter-narrative on migration. Chile's president-elect, José Antonio Kast, will be inaugurated March 11th, at a moment when migration is top of mind. The country's foreign-born population increased by nearly 50% between 2018 and 2023, and Mr. Kast has promised to crack down on unauthorized immigrants. But in Valparaiso, Eduardo Dib, whose family is of Lebanese and Syrian descent, launched a museum late last year that offers a counter-narrative by showing how migration from Europe and the Middle East transformed Chile amid its independence movement in the 1800s. And it was written by Whitney Ulick. Our next one, France's towering figures. When Gustave Eiffel envisioned the design for the Eiffel Tower, built in 1889, he decided to adorn the lattice of the first floor with the names of France's greatest scientists. Among the 72 names Mr. Eiffel selected, there was not a single woman. Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo recently released the names of 72 female scientists to join their male counterparts inscribed on the structure. The names will go to an academic panel for approval, and once authorizations to modify the monument are signed, engraving could start in 2027. That was from Colette Davidson. Here's our next one. He was a fearless voice of the people, a philosopher of freedom, and a revolutionary force. That's what Nigerian President Bola Tinubu recently said of his countryman, musician Fela Kuti. Mr. Tinubu joined fans across the globe in celebrating Mr. Kuti, who posthumously became the first African musician to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the February 1st Grammys. Using his genre-bending big band music as his mouthpiece, Mr. Kuti became one of Nigeria's most important political critics in the 1970s and 80s, and his music remains the soundtrack of protest movements in his homeland and beyond. And that was by Ryan Lenora Brown. And our last one here is Investigating is Her Bread and Butter. The City Council in Manchester, England has a nemesis, a British online content creator who posts under the name Zoe Bread. Much of her social media content chronicles trips to museums or puppet making. But in the past year, she has shot to fame as a citizen journalist, probing Manchester parking policies and affordable housing requirements. The quirky investigator who conceals her face behind a bread-shaped mask in her videos has racked up 1.5 million TikTok followers and attention from the BBC, ITV, and other media. And that was from Arthur Bright. And now for Reporters on the Job in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. What this is a map of the world with points indicated on it, and then there's a title and a couple of paragraphs about each point. Wonder where they got that idea. Hey, the first one here is from Nook Greenland and is written by Mark Sappenfield. I have decided that I don't have any time for journalists anymore. Surely, many sources I've called over the years have had this thought, but none have ever said it aloud so bluntly. That line from an expert at the University of Greenland merely punctuated my 5 days in Nook, Greenland's capital, is exhausted with journalists. The media hordes came when U.S. President Donald Trump started making noise about annexing the islands a year ago, and they have never left this town of 20,000. It has been overrun by microphones, cameras, questions, but I found that once a conversation began, there was ample time, food, and hospitalities. The next one is from Aguinaldo, Mexico, and it's written by Whitney Hewlett. I've read about reporters who travel on assignment with their families. When a recent reporting trip to a monarch butterfly reserve coincided with a school break, it felt like the perfect moment to bring my family along. My children were helpful assistants, noticing details I might have missed. My 4-year-old spotted a lair of dead butterflies spread among plants on a hillside at his eye level. My 9-year-old described monarchs clumped along tree branches and looking like dead leaves, which was more apt than any of the descriptions I'd come across. I left the reserve satisfied that mixing work and family isn't impossible, and sometimes it's worth the extra effort. Our next one is from Boston, and it's written by Cameron Pooh. Information is a reporter's greatest asset, but as I recently found while reporting a story tracking excessive force claims against immigration and customs enforcement, information isn't always easy to find. I wanted to know whether the number of people accusing ICE of excessive force increased in the past year. After pouring through reports and not finding definitive answers, I started calling immigration lawyers. Almost uniformly, they reported a rise in clients seeking to file lawsuits accusing ICE of causing injury. I knew then that I had a story, and it drove home an important reminder. Often the best information doesn't come from a computer screen. It comes from people. And the last one here is from Washington, and it's written by Caitlin Babcock, and it says, reporting on Congress often means reacting quickly. In the U.S. Senate basement, I was looking for lawmakers for a shutdown funding story. An elevator dinged, a senator stepped out, and was thronged by reporters. But something else caught my eye. Almost unnoticed, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, a Democratic senator key to my story, was entering a subway train that connects the Senate to members' office buildings. I popped my head in. Can I ride with you? 2 other reporters joined. As we rode together for 5 minutes through underground tunnels, we had a rare, unrushed conversation away from the microphones and clamor. And now for the explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. The prediction market boom and backlash. Betting on outcomes of real-world events often is more accurate than traditional polls, but it raises concerns about cheating and corrosion of trust. This is written by Patrick Johnson, who is a staff writer. A growing number of Americans are betting on game scores, weather patterns, technology releases, and even when Taylor Swift and football player Travis Kelce will get married. They are joining prediction markets, online pools wagering on the outcomes of real-world events that have turned niche speculation into a mainstream form of trading. These betting markets are booming, with trading up from $9 billion in 2024 to over $44 billion in 2025. They are valuable, experts say, because they often create more accurate forecasting models in politics and business than traditional polls. And bettors say crowdsourced wagers are a potentially profitable way to engage in sports like the Olympics and other events. With the boom has come backlash, though, not just from sports fans, but also from sports leagues and public officials worried about the risk of rigged wagers where a player might balk for a bet. The NFL, for example, banned ads for prediction market sites like Kelce, Predictit, and Polymarket during the Super Bowl, citing concerns about legal gray areas and game integrity. But the risks extend beyond these markets to other forms of wagering, such as recent sportsbook betting allegations involving NBA figures. One notable historical precedent is the 1919 Black Sox scandal, in which several Chicago White Sox players took bribes to throw the World Series, a conspiracy that shattered public trust and led to lifetime bans for stars like Shoeless Joe Jackson. For many centuries, people have wanted to legally restrict these sorts of activities, says Robin Hansen, a George Mason University economist and a pioneer in prediction markets research. Yes, we've carved out exceptions because we see social value in them, he says, referring to once illegal activities such as stocks, insurance, and auctions. But technically, they're all gambling. And what follows now is a question and answer piece. Question: how did prediction markets start and why are they popular? Answer: in the early 1900s, betting markets on elections often exceeded the value of transactions on the U.S. stock exchanges. As the overall accuracy of and trust in election polling have faltered in recent years, interest in prediction markets has resurfaced. In traditional legal gambling, people place bets against the house, which sets fixed odds and is regulated at the state level. In prediction markets, people are betting directly against each other, and the marketplaces are regulated federally as exchanges. In both cases, the businesses make money through different forms of transaction fees, and in both cases, bettors can win multiples of what they wager if betting against the odds. Modern prediction markets trace their origins to 1988, when professors at the University of Iowa's Tippie College of Business developed a market to predict the winner of that year's presidential race between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis. The idea, now known as the Iowa Electronic Markets, was that people who bet their own money on outcomes would produce more accurate predictions than standard polls. Over the next 20 years, the system continued to produce reliable results. By 2007, a study found that the IEM was proving more accurate than 74% of some 1,000 opinion polls analyzed between 1988 and 2004. Today, sites allow people to place bets or event contracts on real-world events that could happen in the future. These are typically simple yes or no bets of up to 99 cents with payouts based on how many people participate and the odds of the event happening. The long-term vision is to financialize everything and create a tradable asset out of any difference of opinion, Tarek Mansour, a Kalshi co-founder, said at a conference last year. Question: why the pushback? Answer: critics see prediction markets as increasingly risky and part of a rise in the gamblification of society. Earlier this year, several states moved to restrict prediction market activities, arguing that the companies were using the markets not only for legitimate forecasting, but also for sports gambling. In a February 2nd statement, New York Attorney General Letitia James warned that prediction sites could expose New Yorkers to significant financial risk and that the industry could face penalties for unlicensed sports wagering in New York. Online betting in general, not limited to prediction markets, has been linked to an increase in bankruptcies. About 1 in 5 online sports bettors, often young men, show signs of a gambling disorder. Question, and this probably is the final question: why are sports leagues and public officials speaking out? And the final answer: the NFL and other sports leagues now accept standard sports betting, but some are concerned about looser regulations governing the new, albeit similar, prediction markets. Betting, many argue, can attract new fans and keep existing ones engaged. The NHL, for one, has partnered with prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket. And there are already active legal and regulated markets, or prediction markets, in play ahead of the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milan Cortina. But golf's PGA Tour, like the NFL, has officially blocked players from endorsing prediction markets, saying they operate in a regulatory gray zone that creates legal and reputational risks. And while the NBA has not issued a league-wide ban, it has voiced concerns. Bets, some league officials argue, undermine the integrity of games and the trust that binds teams and fans. The NCAA is facing a point-shaving scandal in which players sabotage games to make money, involving dozens of people in multiple teams. In January, the NCAA president sought a pause in the use of prediction markets for college sports. Beyond sports, public officials worry that prediction markets allow insiders to make signal bets or moves meant to identify undervalued betting opportunities, giving one group of bettors an advantage over the general public. Critics also say that betting on violent or lethal events could cross moral and ethical boundaries. Last June, one polymarket yes/no bet was on Israel military action against Iran by Friday. When the strike happened, one user made $128,000 on the bet. Another user profited more than $400,000 on a contract over when Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro's rule would end, raising concerns of inside knowledge of the U.S. raid that ousted him. U.S. Representative Richie Torres, a New York Democrat, recently introduced the Public Integrity and Financial Prediction Markets Act of 2026, which, if passed, would bar government officials from using insider information for financial gain. And now we find ourselves in the home forum section of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There is one article and one poem, and I will read both of them. The article is entitled, Putting My Stamp on a Lost Art. Always dialed into the digital world, one writer finds respite in his postcard pastime, proof of the old truth that givers get more than receivers. This is written by Danny Heitman. As a loyal soldier in the digital revolution, I write dozens of emails each day, along with scores of texts and my usual share of social media posts. But recently, I've become a regular sender of postcards, embracing a tradition once popular in an earlier century. Dropping them into the mail always makes me smile, proof of the old truth that givers get more from such gestures than receivers. I didn't set out to revive a lost art or make some larger point when I took up my postcard pastime. Like so many of life's happy turns, it came about by serendipity. While in Pittsburgh to attend my son's college graduation, our family spent a sunny morning at Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens, one of the city's star attractions. We like to stop by the gift shop when we visit museums and public gardens, though my wife and I are empty nesters, more interested in downsizing our possessions than in acquiring new stuff. But gift shops help keep cultural institutions afloat, so we make token purchases when we can as a small nod of support. Though warm spring weather told us that the Yuletide season was months away, my wife selected some Christmas ornaments to remind us of Phipps during the holidays. While standing in line with her at the cash register, I spotted a rack of postcards. For a few years now, I've brought home postcards from various places and perched them along a bookshelf near my home computer, creating a private gallery that reminds me of faraway destinations. Clattering at my keyboard, I often glance at a postcard from a Van Gogh exhibition in Dallas, for example, and mentally travel into one of his vivid olive groves brightened by a luminous cloud. With that pleasant idea in mind, I purchased a few postcards depicting Phipps' botanical wonders, including a cactus as big as a bushel basket and a blue blossom grand as a windmill that seemed to radiate warmth. They looked like great candidates for the bookshelf tableau in my home office. Once we returned home, though, I could see that the improvised art exhibit in my home office was getting cluttered. I felt greedy hoarding all those visual treasures, and I was beginning to understand that postcards don't really reach their promise unless they're sent to someone else. These are those beautifully colored miniatures, a snowy woodscape, a pink dog rose, an impressionist painting of two women on a sailboat, now struck me as oddly constrained in my bookcase, like tropical birds confined to a cage. Fetching a ballpoint pen and a book of stamps, I decided to set them free. I addressed one to a friend who had recently lost his job, another to someone navigating new struggles at home. I inscribed a third postcard to my son in Massachusetts and scribbled greetings on a fourth card to my daughter in California. What I learned in doing so is that postcards are a perfect balance between a hastily composed email and the long, leisurely pace of a handwritten letter. Their compact format, which nudges writers to keep the message short and sweet, chimes with our hurried times. But the physical presence of a postcard with its bright art and durable cardstock is a pleasure that abides more vividly than any message in an inbox. Which is why, though most of the postcards from my shelf have flown the coop to other homes, I've continued to send them, and I now even buy them in bulk. A new box arrived this morning, luminous reproductions of masterpieces by Henri Matisse. I'm not yet sure where they'll end up, but I'm fortunate to live within a circle of friends and family who welcome whatever cheer might happen to land in their mailbox. Who knows? I might even get a few postcards in return. All right, here is the postcard. It's written by Fihero Okifo. It's called No One. And when they came for me, there was no one left to speak for me. So I learned to speak for myself. But when I no longer needed them, there they were. And now for the editorials in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. There are three of them. And here's the first one. Lifelines amid a deep fake flood. Concern over how easily artificial intelligence can be used to produce highly believable deep fake images, especially non-consensual sexualized depictions of adults and children, is at an all-time high. It follows the recent flood of such imagery produced through Grok, the generative AI chatbot linked to the worldwide social media platform X. France, Britain, and other governments have begun investigations while some temporarily shut down national access to Grok. In the United States, lawmakers and some watchdog groups have called for new laws. Last month, X announced restrictions to Grok's capabilities in public posts. But Reuters reported that, when prompted, the chat box continued to create sexualized images several weeks later. At the heart of the matter is how best to balance First Amendment free speech protections with legal and social expectations of accountability and corporate ethics. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression cautioned against a rush to regulate. The right response, it said, is to enforce existing laws and resist the temptation to trade constitutional principles for the illusion of control. Some analysts and tech sector leaders believe otherwise. When a company offers generative AI tools, it is their responsibility to minimize the risk. Sloan Thompson of EndTAB, which tracks tech facilitated abuse, told Wired, X has done the opposite. They've embedded AI-enabled image abuse directly into a mainstream platform. In January, Dario Amodei, the CEO of AI firm Anthropic, noted that the technology is entering a risky period of adolescence. Mr. Amodei has often called for regulations that would require AI companies to disclose how they guide model behaviors and incorporate standards that protect privacy and dignity. The Harvard Law Review last year pointed to the three-decades-old Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which limits publisher and distributor liability for internet platforms. In the age of generative AI, this section may have outgrown its original purpose, it said. The purpose of the First Amendment is to protect core forms of human expression, the journal noted. This can include what is sometimes referred to as lawful but awful content. But as much as humans rely on the automated work of AI, those systems do not have morality, intelligence, or ideas, it noted, and should not receive the same protections as humans. According to Anthropic's Mr. Amodei, if we act decisively and carefully, the risks can be overcome, and there's a hugely better world on the other side of this phase of AI transformation. Our next editorial is entitled, Europe's Future Hinges on Hungary. A rise in anti-corruption movements in Europe has upended politics from Serbia to Bulgaria to Romania. Now, one of the continent's most entrenched leaders, Prime Minister Viktor Orbán of Hungary, faces a serious challenge this April in an election that could be determined by what one commentator calls a public yearning for integrity. For the European Union, too, the stakes in the election are high. Mr. Orbán and his populist conservative party, Fidesz, have often obstructed the 27-member bloc's efforts to help Ukraine and counter Russia. The EU has also held back funds for Budapest over its shrinking rule of law. After nearly 16 years under Mr. Orbán, Hungary has the lowest living standards in the EU. Its 9.6 million people have experienced 3 years of economic stagnation. It is also ranked by Transparency International as the EU's most corrupt nation. Voters are finally linking anti-democratic misrule with their economic misery, and independent polls show an anti-corruption party, Respect and Freedom, or the TISA party, with a wide lead over Fidesz. The party's leader, Peter Magyar, has shot up in popularity after 2 years of touring the country with warnings about the private use of public money by Fidesz. Fidesz is much more than me. It's a movement of the vast majority of the Hungarian people against corruption, lies, propaganda, and autocracy, Mr. Magyar told Deutsche Welle. He promises to strengthen judicial independence and nepotism in government and make other reforms to curb graft. Mr. Orbán's political machine and media control might yet prevent a TISA win, but, says EU Today editor Gary Cartwright, if polls hold, Hungary is on the brink of one of the most significant political transformations in its recent history. In the crucible of early 21st century European politics, Magyar's ascendancy is a reminder that democratic renewal remains possible, even after years of drift towards authoritarian proximity and geopolitical ambivalence. And here is the third and final editorial. It is entitled, Ukrainians Embrace a War Anniversary. To the rest of the world, Ukrainians might have little reason to commemorate the fourth anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion on February 24th. Their country is enduring one of its worst winters. Heat and electricity are scarce from missile attacks on energy facilities. An estimated 200,000 Ukrainian soldiers have gone AWOL. And last year was the worst year yet for the number of civilians killed in the war. For Ukraine, each day is a day of blood, death, tears, and struggle. Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk, head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, told OSV News. Yet, with a gumption and ingenuity that they have also mustered to keep the Russian military from making sizable advances, Ukrainians will mark the day with various expressions of gratitude, unity, and perhaps solemn celebration. One event will be the first nationwide day of prayer. One reason for the event, church attendance is up, especially as many places of worship have become humanitarian hubs to help the needy. People are searching for meaning. I see it every day, said Major Archbishop Shevchuk. There are moments when anyone asks, where is God? Have we been forgotten? But our people are finding answers here in community, prayer, perseverance, he said. Around the world, Ukrainians abroad will mark the anniversary with vigils and rallies, as they have in recent years. Some military experts suggest the world also note how Ukraine has become a marvel in designing its own drones and cruise missiles. The UN Security Council will hold a special session on February 24th to discuss the impact of the war on Ukrainians. The European Parliament plans to approve a 90 billion euro or $107 billion loan to Kyiv from European Union member states on that day. Top EU officials will be in Ukraine for the anniversary. Moscow is not invincible. On the battlefield, its army is at a standstill. At home, its economy is in crisis, wrote Kaja Kallas, the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, on the social media platform X. Increased pressure together with our partners and increased military support to Ukraine can shorten this war. Ukraine has done much to both endure and recover, especially in Bucha, scene of the first mass killing of civilians by Russia. The city has been rebuilt. We needed to transform a place of tragedy into a place for living again, former city council member Mykolnya Shakhovishka told commonspace.eu. Every sign of normal life, our families, community, friends, motivates us, she added. Even during conflict, people kept cooking borscht and mashed potatoes, tending to daily life and celebrating the small moments, and the big events, like an anniversary of a war's beginning. Hey, we got less than 2 minutes left, so I'll read the Reader's Respond, which are basically letters to the editor. And this one here says, looking good! Hooray! What an inspiring new look for the Monitor Weekly. Simplicity of layout, parts where they belong, all clearly identified, and, best of all, no doubt about the identity of the publication. What a joy to see this freshness at this particular moment in civilization's struggle to do better. I get the sense of strong continuation of the Monitor's desire to connect with people all over. And that was from Sarah Barnacle from Dover, New Hampshire. And this one, an America without rules of the road. The Global Patterns Commentary, How Will the World Adapt to America's Unilateralism, in the January 26 Monitor Weekly, uses the example of Hans Mondermann's challenges to traditional thinking about street engineering to seemingly rationalize Donald Trump's challenges to the world order. The article suggests that in the anarchy that comes from threatening the existing world order and eliminating the rules we follow, we will be like motorists without rules of the road and will be more cautious in our relations and safer in an environment where no one is quite sure where they stand with each other. And the lesson of Motorman's critique was not the elimination of rules, but the application of new techniques of traffic management and rules based upon a shared understanding of what would help improve road safety. And I got to truncate this. This is written by John T. Spence from Covington, Kentucky. Because by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.